On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we bring in special co-host Kevin Brown. No, not the pitcher. The broadcaster, the voice of the Baltimore Orioles, joins me to celebrate Joshua Baez's historic MLB debut. Then we run through the AL wild card fiasco. All of these teams are good. All of these teams are bad. Kevin will argue for them. I will argue against them. And then we make fun of Kyle Tucker, talk about the Brewers beating the Dodgers, fly through the rest of the games from the weekend. It was a joy. I have the second best voice on the upcoming podcast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world messier than the AL wildcard picture. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Orioles broadcaster Kevin Brown. Hello, Kevin.
This whole time, I really thought you were Jordan.
It's not the first time that's happened to me. And you know what? It won't be the last. Jordan's still on vacation, checking out birds up in Maine with his wife. He will be back on Friday. And in his place, in his stead, we have called upon the voice of a generation.
Which generation would you say that is?
Your two children.
I only currently have one. Okay. Although, well, you could count the dog as a second.
Kevin, thank you for coming on. You are currently what city pleasure. And about to do what for your job?
Yeah, I'm currently in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm at the lovely hotel name Redacted. And tonight, ESPN, 7 o'clock, Tigers-Pirates, a game we thought a few weeks ago would probably feature a wild card contender. We just didn't think it'd be this one.
And that's going to be our conversation later on as the AL wild card picture is a disgusting mess. We'll pick through that wreckage and we'll tell you why we believe in some teams and why we don't believe in others. But because we had history over the weekend, we will begin with Joshua freaking Baez. Let's not beat around the bush. This is the single greatest debut in the history of Major League Baseball. Joshua Baez called up by the St. Louis Cardinals, first career MLB game on Saturday, goes yard in his first plate appearance, goes yard in his second plate appearance, and goes yard in his third plate appearance. That is right. Three trips to the dish, three long balls at Wrigley Field in his debut, all three off of Cubs lefty vet Matt Boyd. He lined out to left field in his fourth at-bat. He couldn't get the job done. His first career out made later on in that game. The Cubs fans gave him a standing ovation, not something you see quite often when the Cardinals are in town. Kevin, what did we see here? What did we watch? What was this?
I'd love to come on here and be contrarian and say, well, actually, Jake, it was like the fourth best major league debut in history. I can't get there. I couldn't find anything offensively that was like, there are some really cool pitching debuts, right?
Sure.
I mean, there's Strasburg in 2010 when he struck out 14. There's Juan Marichal at a no-hitter for 7 2/3 in his debut and one hit, 12 strikeouts against the Phillies. There's Bumpus Jones in 1892. Y'all remember Bumpus Jones, who threw a no-hitter in his debut. You're a big Bumpus guy. October 15th, 1892, Reds Pirates, or whatever they were called at the time, did allow a run. But no one has ever had an offensive debut like this. No one. And I mean, I just want to know where this ranks for the best first pitches of a major league career. Because the guys have homered on the first pitch they've seen, but to go 449 to dead center in Wrigley in a Cubs-Cardinals game, that alone is sick. And I don't know if people saw yesterday, but a rookie named Brett Callahan came up for the Tigers. And Brett, on the first pitch of his career, lined a two-run triple in a very important Tigers-White Sox game. And that is really cool. And it's also like, by a magnitude of 27 times, not as impressive as what we saw in Wrigley Field?
So the one that does come to mind is Daniel Nava, who hit a grand slam on the first ever pitch he saw for the Red Sox. But you're right. There was something about the home run that Joshua Baez hit, the first one. 449 to dead center over the batter's eye, just to the left of it. That perfectly encapsulated what this player is. Joshua Baez has some of the wildest, wackiest, top of the scale raw power that exists in professional baseball, that exists on the planet. And so for him to say, oh, sure, the first pitch I ever see, here's the thing that I do for a living, was wonderful theater. The second plate appearance is the one that I was thinking a lot about, because like when he comes back up for the second one, you're not necessarily thinking, is he going to do it again? He does do it again on a full count. Everybody at Wrigley Field cannot help but have the idea of no way he can do it a third time pop into their minds. And when he gets a pitch, a 1-0 slider, this is the one he went backside on and poked it out to left. Like, it just unbelievable performance here from Joshua Baez. And the journey that this kid has been on for a 2021 high school pick, it took him a long time to get here. He gets drafted in the second round by the Cardinals in 2021 out of an inner city Boston area high school. Born in Boston, moves to the Dominican as an infant, moves back to Boston around 11 years old with very little English, settles in Dorchester in Boston, 5 miles away from Wrigley Field, and just turns out to be this physical freak who works his tush off. I wrote a feature about Joshua Baez back in 2021 before he got drafted by the Cardinals, where I talked to him and a bunch of his coaches kind of about how unique of a journey this kid had to get into affiliated baseball or get into kind of being a top draft prospect. The stories about him in high school were legendary. I mean, he was facing kids that were throwing like 80 and he was hitting balls 450 feet. And so there was real concern from a lot of organizations like, yes, this is a physical freak. Can he face real pitching? Heading into his senior year, Kevin, he had an offer to go to IMG in Florida, right? IMG, which is thought of as like this sports incubator. And Baez, he turned it down. Okay. He turned it down and he decided to stay in Boston so he could like be around his community and be with his family and be with his friends. And for a little bit in pro ball, that looked like maybe a bad decision. As he got his doors blown off for a couple of years in the minors, everything clicks last year in the minors. This season, AAA hits 34 home runs, gets called up on Saturday, and delivers a debut of a lifetime.
You know, we had in Major League Baseball the Field of Dreams game on Thursday. And 2 days later, it felt like we were doing The Natural. Like all we were missing was Randy Newman and a little light tower knockout. The more I read about this kid, the more blown away I am. And I, bad friend that I am, had not read your piece. And I'm ashamed to say, as somebody who follows the sport closely, I didn't know Joshua Baez. Maybe I'd heard his name, but I think the first time I was aware of Joshua Baez was Saturday when he went 449 on the first pitch. And then, I don't know, 38 minutes later, whatever, get a text in the group chat. Oh, he said another one. And then like the whole group chat that I'm in is on high alert. And now we're watching every Joshua Baez at bat because it had become an event already. The story that blows me away is that he earlier this year had a 4-homer game in AAA on the 3-year anniversary of his dad's passing. His dad, Jose, who had died 3 years ago, and Josh said his dad's dream was to play in the big leagues, and the only promise I made to him was that I was going to be able to do that for him. And then he hits 4 freaking home runs 3 years after his dad passed away, and then 2 months later hits 3 in his big league debut. By the way, you showed a picture earlier. I don't think I've seen in my life a bigger friends and family section than the Joshua Baez cheering section at Wrigley Field. That's like a Marlins game right there. It's like the whole attendance of a Marlins game. It's just the Baez family. I mean, this is like a third of the people that were in the stands going crazy for this kid. And how do they get all these seats in Wrigley? It's hard to find this seats in Wrigley.
That's the other thing. That's the other thing here is that, like, if he was playing in Boston and he had a ton of people, and like all of these people flew out. I think we're talking maybe 40 people, 35 people. They all flew out to Chicago, bought Cardinals jerseys to watch him put on a show. And they were rewarded in kind because they saw something that no one in attendance will ever forget. My sister's boyfriend was at this game. And he just texted me in all caps, Joshua Baez. And I was like, yeah, it's pretty sick. He was like, no, I was there. Like, I was in attendance for this.
Same.
And I'm curious for you, Kevin, like, you've obviously never called three home runs for a debut before. How would you try to contextualize this in the moment when it's happening as a broadcaster?
The genuine answer is it's hard to say because I haven't done it, but debuts are always super special to me. I always try as the broadcaster to, number one, obviously meet the player beforehand. Don't want to overwhelm them. Just want to say hi. Want to say, hey, you know, who's here? Mom, dad, wife, girlfriend, brother, sister, whatever. Like, I want to have a couple of biggest important enemy. Names because I know biggest enemy. Yeah. Who's the kid in third grade that said you weren't going to make it and, you know, threw a cream cheese and jelly sandwich at you? Where is he right now?
Dude,
I want to know.
Wait, sorry. The idea of a guy making his big league debut inviting the teacher that told him that he was never going to be a big leaguer to the debut.
Great bit,
is
right?
So
great
funny.
Bit.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. There's mom Janice and there's his dad Oliver. And yeah, there's old Mr. Sixsmith who said, if you don't show up to English class tomorrow, I'm going to beat you with a ruler and you'll never be seen again. normalize teacher enemies, I think, is what we've come up with here. I want to know who's there. So when our director, who's the person in the broadcast truck who decides what shots are going on air, when our director inevitably cuts to the family, I want to know who's there. I want to know, when did they get there, right? If you got any travel stories, they had to wake up at 6 a.m. and take a red eye the night before, whatever. And you want to learn what you can from maybe the hitting coach or the pitching coach who might have some kind of report on them. And then you just want to start digging for what people like you or some of our local journalists have done. So you want to be armed with some kind of information just to contextualize it, right? A debut is... It is literally, by its definition, is a one-of-a-kind thing. I'm not arrogant enough to say when somebody makes a debut, they're going to go back and like watch and listen to the broadcast. But I know there are family and I know there are friends and I know there are people who had an important impact on this person that'll be watching. And I want to, in a bite-sized form, capture their story. But then when the game starts, who the hell knows? And you have debuts where guys are 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts, a lot more likely than this. So how do you contextualize this? My gosh, I don't know. I it would be all I had not to just scream my head off and lose my voice by the second one he hit, let alone the third. Yeah. It's something I think about, and this is advice I got a couple of years back from our mutual friend, the great Jason Medeni, voice of Sunday Night Baseball. I was calling a college basketball game and I had a buzzer beater and I called the buzzer beater and then I laid out for what I thought was a little bit too long. And it's not a bad call. I hit the buzzer beater, but then I didn't really, you know, bring the moment home pointedly. And I was telling him I didn't feel great about it and I felt like I missed something. And he said, you know, just like think of the emotion of the moment and think of what the emotion is, if you can, for that person and that team and that fan base. So on a day like that for Joshua Baez, try to get inside his head and his family's head as much as possible and get inside his mom's head, as we see the quote to Danny on the screen and try to contextualize, like, what in the world could this possibly mean to him? And what could this possibly mean to the Baez people? And I think that's the responsibility you ultimately have.
I think this quote, which I will now read. So Danny Wex, friend of the program, former guest host of this show, and sideline reporter for the Cardinals, asks to Joshua Baez's mother, "Are you surprised by the three home runs?" And Joshua Baez's mom says, "No, he already hit four in one game at AAA." That is a perfect example of how everyone in Joshua Baez's orbit has immense confidence in this kid, in this character, to conjure these moments of greatness because he has been doing it his entire life. Yes, it was against, you know, kids fresh out of history class in the Boston City High School League and on fields that had bad drainage in 38 degree weather, but he was cranking the crap out of balls for over a decade now. And so for the parents, yes, this is amazing and wonderful, but I love the idea. They're like, yeah, this is what he does. And the emotion that we saw from the Memphis Redbirds, the AAA team with whom Joshua spent most of this season. I don't know if you saw this, Kevin. It is like a video from inside the Redbirds clubhouse of them watching the third home run. And so they've spent all year with Joshua Baez, who has been hitting four home runs in a game, balls over 450 feet, balls 118 miles an hour. And so when he gets a hold of the third one and the room loses its mind, this sort of unencumbered joy, this like freedom, this overflow of emotion for another human being, I think is so beautiful and just gets at the essence of what makes sports great.
Do you remember the name, and I don't know why you would, except that you're you, Paolo Espino?
Of course.
Yeah.
Paolo Espino, Dominican winter ball legend. I believe Paolo Espino has a very unfortunate record that Jordan could speak to. He went like 0-9 in his first 10 star. He like didn't get a win for a long time.
Mm-hmm. The reason I bring that up is I was in AAA with the Syracuse Chiefs for 7 years, and we had Paolo Espino for a couple of, he's like 5'9", 5'10", big loopy curveball, probably topped out around 92. Minor league guy forever, org depth guy, would bounce between AA and AAA. And I remember when he got called up, and I think he was with the Brewers at the time for his debut. And the Chiefs were a Nationals affiliate. He'd spent most of his time in the Nats system. And I just remember before one game, it was a day game, and Paolo was pitching, and our team was out stretching, and they were so invested in this. They wanted the Brewers-Cubs game to go on the scoreboard at NBT Bank Stadium in Syracuse, and his guys are stretching and warming up. They're locked in because Paolo's on the mound, and they all felt like they shared a part of that journey with him. And I think that is the great thing about the minor leagues, is you can have guys there, and you will, that are cynical that they're not up, and maybe are cynical that they've been up to the big leagues and are down. But when one of your guys makes it and makes it for the first time, it's as pure, uncut joy, I think, as professional baseball gets. And when you have something like you had with Joshua Baez, and the story you detailed, and where he came from, and a high school that had produced no major league players, in a state that is obviously known for the Red Sox, but is not known for developing amateur talent. It's just one of those preposterous once-in-a-lifetime things. Like, for the next 150 years of baseball, if there's still Major League Baseball in 150 years, we'll still be putting this Joshua Baez game on the list of greatest debuts ever. And there will still be the quote from his mom being unsurprised about the four homers, and the video of the Memphis guys going nuts. And there'll be the fact that, oh, by the way, he said there was a bee that was hovering around him for all nine innings in the outfield. And he just took that as a sign that his dad was with him and that he's never had a bee or a bug around him for nine innings. So, like, this is the stuff of legends, and it happened at a place in Wrigley that compels those legends just by its very existence.
Something we will never, ever forget. Baez, to soil the party, went 0 for 5 on Sunday with three strikeouts because guess what? Yeah. Baseball is very, very, very difficult to be good at. Joshua Baez, for all the power, for all of the juice, has quite a big swing. There was a lot of swing and miss. That how much contact he makes will determine whether he is Aaron Judge or Jordan Walker or Adam Brett Walker. And so time will certainly tell. The Cardinals end up winning this series, taking the finale on Sunday with homers from Alec Burleson and the aforementioned Jordan Walker. They're only 3.5 back, hanging around the NL wildcard picture. If Joshua Baez stays hot, maybe they can crawl back into that thing. Kevin, let's take a break. And when we get back, we will pivot from the joy of Joshua Baez to the teeth-grinding frustration that is the AL wildcard race. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. If you go to MLB.com and click standings, don't do it. Make sure you're seated and you have water and you're in a healthy mental place, because it might frustrate you. That is, unless you are a Baltimore Orioles fan, because in the AL wildcard race, as we sit here today, the team that Kevin Brown waxes poetic about for most of his time at work is in a wild card spot. That is incomprehensible. The Baltimore Orioles took the first three games of a series against the Tampa Bay Rays over the weekend. There is an opportunity today on Monday for them to finish off the four-game drubbing. Those O's are currently 61-63, two games below 500. A half game above the Texas Rangers, who are 61-64, and then goes the Detroit Tigers, the Minnesota Twins, the Cleveland Guardians, the Seattle Mariners, and that's it. We won't say the Kansas City Royals. All of these teams, from the Orioles
Wait a minute,
to the Mariners.
To
yeah?
I think you forgot the Blue Jays.
There's too many teams, Kevin. The Toronto Blue Jays are also one game back of the Baltimore Orioles. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 teams fighting for one spot, 2.5 games spread out. So we could go through the beat by beat from this weekend, but I think what I would like to do, Kevin, is go through each of these teams. We could play good cop, bad cop, good Kevin, bad Jake. You are an optimistic individual. I'm a hater. Not really, but I can play hater. We're going to give a reason why each of these teams are real and each of these teams are false. And we will start in Tampa Bay, where the Baltimore Orioles shocked the world with three wins over the weekend.
First of all, I love this. I am an optimist by nature. I love this persona. You and I are going to be like the Liam Neeson character in the Lego movie, a reference that I'm sure all your listeners understand. Listen, do I have to sell you on the Orioles? They're leading the wild card. They're the leaders already. Oh, right. And here's the deal. Yeah, scoreboard, bro. Here's why you believe in the Orioles. You believe in the Orioles because they may have the best 1-2 punch of all these teams in the wild card race. They have a guy named Pete Alonso. Ever heard of him? Last seven games, 15 for 25, 600, four homers, nine ribbies, 688 on base percentage. And they have Gunnar Henderson, who's 25 years old, and 2 years ago was an 8-WAR player and hit 37 homers and stole 21 bases and finished fourth in American League MVP voting and has had a downright frustrating, mystifying year. And every time you think he's going to get going, he hasn't. But three hits and a home run at Minnesota on the road trip a couple of days ago. Four hits and a homer the opener at Tampa Bay. At-bats have been a lot better the past week. I refuse to believe that Gunnar Henderson is the guy he's been the first few months of this year. he's going to have a turnaround. And if he turns it around over the last couple of months, there may be no more impactful player to the wild card race than Gunnar Henderson, a sleeping giant next to an actual giant in Pete Alonso. And that is why the Orioles can see this thing through to the postseason.
The reason they cannot is that they traded their good relievers away, their good players away. The three, I believe, of their top seven players by BWAR, that is Taylor Ward, that is Adley Rutschman, that is Tyler Wells, were all dealt away at the deadline. And getting rid of good baseball players is not usually an optimal strategy to winning baseball games. This club has played messy, disorganized baseball for a lot of the season. I do believe that they have played better of late. That is obvious. They just, you know, showed up in Tropicana Field, a place where they do not have a good time very often, and had a very nice time. I just don't know if they can out-crisp the Guardians, right? If they can out-pitch the Tigers, if they can out-vibe the Blue Jays, if they can out-talent the Mariners. Are they the best at anything of this group? You do bring up a good point in terms of the 1-2 punch. I would counter with the concept of Cal Raleigh and Julio Rodriguez, but you are correct that the reality of those two probably is not quite what Gunnar and Pete can deliver. And then the big concern is, what do you do with Yoel Pozo? So Yoel Pozo, who has stepped in as the Orioles' backup catcher the last week and change as Samuel Basayo works his way back from the IL. Yoel Pozo yesterday, after drawing a walk, got some shine for grabbing his jingle berries, his nether regions, his in a very overt manner, his Bozo, his Yoel Pozos towards the dugout, and making the entire dugout cackle in laughter. How do they keep Pozo around once Basayo gets back?
Carry three catchers, because Basayo's going to DH some. They've done it before this year. They have carried three catchers at times. Would you carry a third catcher for vibes? I don't know, maybe.
The Philadelphia Phillies are doing that right now with friend of the program, Garrett Stubbs. And those Philadelphia Phillies swept the Minnesota Twins this weekend. First game was the Field of Dreams celebration. We talked about that on Friday's show. This weekend, the Phillies went out. They beat Connor Prelip on Saturday, drawing a ton of walks, kind of forcing him out of the game. Five hits for Alec Bohm. Just when you think he's out, he pulls you back in, pulls himself back in. Then on Sunday, the Phillies go down 5-0 to Andrew Painter after he gives up a grand slam. They battle back behind four Alec Bohm RBI, a disastrous sweep loss for the Minnesota Twins. Those Minnesota Twins who remain just 1.5 games adrift of the wildcard spot. Kevin, why are the Minnesota Twins real?
When you get down to a postseason push, when you're in tight baseball, what do you need? You need the big hit. Who's the best team in the American League with runners in scoring position? That's right.
I'm going to guess the Minnesota Twins.
You're so right, Jake. 790 team OPS. Look at some of these players. Josh Bell, 344 runners in scoring position. Ryan Jeffers, 333 OPS, 1,090. Brooks Lee, 318. Luke Kuechel, 424 on base, runners in scoring position. Maybe it's a sticky thing, right? Runner in scoring position numbers, but all year long, the Twins have been pretty good at this. And the one guy who really hasn't hit with runners in scoring position is Byron Buxton, 164. Guess what? He's Byron Buxton. That's going to trend up. Twins get the big hits. They added some pitching at the deadline with Dean Kramer, with Jeff Hoppin, with A.J. Minter. In big moments, the Twins are going to come through. That's why the Minnesota Twins can make the postseason.
This is great. We will, whatever ends up happening, we'll just clip that and we'll send it to Kevin. And Kevin will be like, see, I told you all along. And we can clip all the ones that I said.
The show's being released October 4th, right?
Exactly. 100%.
Yeah.
Here's why the Twins are frauds. One, Joe Ryan's hurt. And like that is the main reason their rotation is not good enough. Zebby Matthews, despite being a Zebby, which we love, is not throwing well enough to be a big league starter right now. But in my mind, the Trevor Larnach fiasco at the deadline highlights that something is bizarre about this team, that they tried to trade Trevor Larnach, who is probably their third best hitter and has another year of control. They tried to trade him to the Astros in exchange for Brian Abreu. Brian Abreu, who is a free agent at the end of the season and is a reliever. And the trade got spiked not by the Twins leadership, but by the Astros leadership. And we just had so much to do at the deadline that we never considered that the Twins were weirdly saved by the Astros owner for making a trade that would have not made any sense. And for that reason, I just don't have a whole lot of faith in this operation getting outs and scoring runs when it needs to. Simple enough for me.
I actually didn't even know that about Trevor Larnach. I totally missed that off the deadline nonsense. Yeah. This is the first time hearing about it.
It was a wild thing. Derek Shelton had to call like Trevor Larnach into the office and be like, "Hey, sorry, like we're not trading you. Jim Crane said we're not trading you." And so like he just gets to stay on the Twins. How about that?
Yeah. Well, you know what he does on the Twins, Jake? You know what he does? He hits with Risp. He's a 364 runners in scoring position.
This is like the scene in Moneyball with like he gets on base, except it's Kevin talking about hitting with runners in scoring position. The team that hit a lot with runners in scoring position over the weekend, Chicago White Sox. Chicago White Sox, who are not in the AL wildcard race because they're too damn good for that, baby. The upstart pale hose sweeping their division rival Detroit Tigers in Detroit over the weekend to turn a 2.5 game lead in the division to a 5.5 game lead, leaving the Tigers upstream with no paddle, at least for now, and one game back of the AL wildcard race. The Tigers were also passed over the weekend by the New York Yankees in run differential. The Tigers started the weekend with the best run differential in the American League. They are now second at plus 83, which is still funny because they're 60 and 64. This was a huge series for the Tigers, an opportunity had they swept to take the lead in the American League Central. Instead, Jackson Jobe has a stinker on Friday. Andrew Benintendi burns him on Saturday. And then Munetaka Murakami with a late homer gives the Sox the win in the finale. A thorough performance from Chicago. Kevin Brown, the Tigers, they certainly don't look real, but you say they are?
Hey, real quick, can we just pretend I wasn't listening to your intro? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jake, who do you think has the best run differential in the American League right now?
The Yankees.
That's right, but the Tigers are right behind them, just two runs off the run differential of the Yankees. Hey, how can I rule out the only team in the wild card race with a good run differential? How can I do that? Their luck's going to catch up to them. I know they traded Skubal. I know they traded Mize, but Troy Melton's been amazing. Troy Melton, two runs or less in 9 straight starts going into Saturday, tied for the longest streak in Tigers history. Guy named Justin Verlander. Ever heard of him? Hal Newhouser, ever heard of him? Frank Larry, ever heard of him?
Haven't.
Kader Montero's been really good. Haven't either. Jackson Jobe, stinker, but could be a difference maker. Framber Valdez pitches tonight. He's going to get better. The Tigers have the guy who's going to be the rookie of the year, and Kevin McGonigal. And they have the guy who might lead the American League in F4, in wins above replacement, in Dylan Dingler. So they got the rookie of the year. They got maybe the guy who's going to lead the league in WAR. And they still have deep pitching. And they have the second best run differential in the American League. Easy. Tigers. Playoffs. It's going to happen.
Better rotation ERA since the trade deadline than the Los Angeles Dodgers, for whom Tarek Skubal now
plays. I'm the good cop here, but you're jumping on the bandwagon. You believe in the Tigers.
I do believe in the Tigers. I said on Friday's show that I thought the Tigers would claw back that deficit against the White Sox and win the division. And here I am on Monday morning regretting the follies of my own past. And so I am now out on these cowardly Tigers because they have too many offensive injuries. You mentioned a story earlier where a gentleman, I believe by the name of, you said Tyler Callahan was his name? Brett Callahan, excuse me.
Brett Callahan.
My apologies to Mr. Callahan. Brett Callahan had a cool debut where he hit an RBI triple. Those debuts are awesome. That should be Riley Green, who is hurt, who is on the IL with a number of other Tiger left-handed hitters, including Kerry Carpenter. Matt Vierling is on there now as well. The Tigers have given a lot of at-bats to the likable Ben Malgeri and Hau-Yu Lee, and Corey Jolks is now in the big leagues. Eduardo Valencia has been amazing. Like, that is a really cool story. Do the Tigers have the offensive pieces? That has been the story for a long time, and that is still the story, and I have legitimate concerns given that they're, what, two of their four most dangerous hitters with Carpenter and Green are on the shelf for what seems to be the foreseeable future.
Those are fair concerns. And that's why you're the hater, and that's why I'm the lover.
This really hurts me. I really do see myself as a lover. Another team that sees itself as lovers are the Toronto Blue Jays, who over the weekend almost swept the New York Yankees, but were foiled on Sunday as Ben Rice coughed up the lead in the ninth with an error and then cranked a two-run homer in extras to win it. The Blue Jays took games on Friday and Saturday. Vlad Jr. had a collision and a concussion, and he's on the IL now. They beat Cam Schlittler on Saturday and then pounced on the Yankees bullpen. Aaron Judge, we should just say, is throwing a baseball again for the Yankees. That's good. Maybe he can be back at some point in September. At what level, at what capacity, who the heck can know? Well, let's focus on the Blue Jays, a team that went to the World Series, a team that was inches away from winning it, a team that basically won the World Series more than any team that didn't actually win the World Series. All of the things that happen to you when you win a World Series, the attention, the ticket sales, the purpose of baseball in a place, the memories, they got all that, everything but the parade and the ring. This year has been an utter disappointment. They have gotten hot of late, and now they sit just one game back. Kevin, you believe in them, though.
Well, I don't even have to sell you on the World Series thing. I mean, that's, you went through that. Obviously, why would you write off a team that was just there, that was a non-slide away from winning it? But here's what I'll sell you at. What do you really want here? You want consistency. You want to show up to the ballpark and know your wild card contender can do something well. And of all the teams here, all the possible flotsam and jetsam in this wild card race, does anybody do anything better than the Blue Jays do playing defense? Number two in the majors, fielding run value. Chicago Cubs number one. Yes, they just traded Dalton Varsho. But still, Blue Jays, elite defensive team. Of all of the units of these teams in the wild card race, offense, pitching staff, defense, does anybody have a better unit than the Blue Jays defense? I don't know that anybody does. Throw Dylan Cease onto that, who's going to strike out everybody. Throw Jose Soriano on that. Gets a lot of ground balls. Hey, great defense to do that behind him. The Blue Jays have one constant, and that constant is when you hit the ball in the field, they're going to go get that ball. That's going to keep them in games, and that is why I believe in the Toronto Blue Jays' postseason chances.
They actually have another constant this season, Kevin, and that constant is sucking at offense. I would argue that if you say the Blue Jays have the best single unit in this race, they also have the worst single unit in this race. The Toronto Blue Jays on this season are dead last in Major League Baseball in team OPS, entering today's action with a 678 mark. They have four guys right now: Ernie Clement, Cosmo Okamoto, George Springer, Nathan Lucas, all have August OPSs that start with a four. Vlad being hurt, like, just as he was maybe starting to get hot, not great. Alejandro Kirk has been much better recently. He's the one I'm feeling good about. But this is not a good offense. George Springer took a step back after an amazing 2025. They didn't really replace Bo Bichette. And they've now traded Dalton Varsho, who's a part of that unit from last year. Addison Barger's been hurt. So, like, why should I believe in this team? And the other thing, Kevin, that kind of made me laugh was like, oh, wow, you know, like, the Jays have gotten hot in August. I wonder how they've been doing it. Guess what? It hasn't been offense. Their 632 OPS in August is the third worst mark in the sport. So it's not as if this team, even though they've been winning baseball games, has been like hitting any better. And you know what I learned? You can't win a game 0-0. This is not the World Cup group stage. We're not battling Uzbekistan on a, you know, warm Tuesday evening in Guadalajara anymore, Kevin. This is Major League Baseball, and you have to score more points than the other team. A team that has struggled to score more points than the other team, the Cleveland Guardians, over the weekend, hosted the San Diego Padres. The San Diego Padres said, hey, we'll take that series from you. Thanks. The kicker on Sunday, Casey Mize, for those Padres was great. The Padres hit back-to-back home runs for the first time all season, which is somehow seems impossible. Because when I say like back-to-back home runs, I think about a game in San Diego where the crowd doesn't sit down between the two home runs because they're still like that in my mind is like what the Padres do. I guess not. The Guardians, though, this was not a strong showing. They did pick up the win on Saturday. Joey Cantillo, depending on how spicy you're feeling, he tossed a gem. Stephen Kwan has been a lot better. But, like, what is this team? You know what it is? A team that Kevin Brown believes in.
I'm going to give you some reasons to believe in the Cleveland Guardians right now. You ready for this?
No.
Okay. I'm going to do it anyway. San Francisco, at Colorado, at LA Angels, Kansas City, Toronto, Detroit, at Baltimore, at Minnesota, Chicago White Sox, that's the Athletics, at Boston, at Kansas City. That is the easiest remaining schedule in Major League Baseball. And guess what? We just did this a year ago. September 4th, the Guardians were 11 back last year. They went 19-4 because they got a gem every night. And Parker Messick might be like third in American League Cy Young voting. And they added Foster Griffin. And they got the number one strikeout bullpen in the majors. And Jose Ramirez will get going. And Joe Adell can't make them worse. But it's all about the schedule to me. This is a cakewalk. They have the easiest schedule in baseball. From here on out, the Cleveland Guardians, of course they're going to make the postseason.
So I know I'm supposed to be a bad cop, but as I was preparing to do this segment, the Guardians were the team that I was like, wow, that's a soft schedule, brother. Again, Angels for three, A's for three, Rockies for three, Royals for six, Giants for three. I mean, that is Charmin Ultra Soft. However,
it's tasty.
Are the Guardians good enough to take advantage of it? Do you know who has a higher batting average right now? Jose Ramirez or Austin Hedges?
It's got to be Jose Ramirez, Guardians icon.
No, Kevin, it's Austin Hedges. And actually, Austin Hedges had a higher OPS than Jose Ramirez yesterday, and then that got ruined. I guess, you know, maybe Austin Hedges got out a couple times or Ramirez got on base. Jose Ramirez is having a very uncharacteristic season. He missed some time on the IL and just hasn't gotten going since he's gotten back. The underlying stuff, sure, says that there's no reason to be worried that this is still very much Jose Ramirez. But it is August 17th, and I think Jose Ramirez has a 105 OPS plus. The magic of this team over these years, the one constant, as the steamrollers steam through history, has been Jose Ramirez putting the Guardians or their previous moniker on his very wide shoulders and carrying them with a mixture of grit and unapologetic baseballing aggression. And he just hasn't been that same character. And I just don't know how this team can get to where they want to go without Jose Ramirez working on full cylinder. The Texas Rangers are the most in play of all these wildcard teams from a statistical perspective. They are just a half game out behind the Orioles instead of a full game. They're 61-64. Over the weekend, though, they lost a series to the Athletics. They got hashtag sacked. Nailed it. I'm not going to go beat by beat through the series because guess what? There were a lot of home runs in Sacramento and the visiting team lost. Who would have thought? These Rangers, since winning the World Series in 2023, have just been the epitome of mid. They've been the epitome. You believe in them, though.
What do you need to win baseball games?
Cleats.
You need balls, cleats. Bats, and the
friendship.
Yeah. The Rangers have cleats, balls, bats, can't speak to friendship. But what they do have, you need runs. How do you get runs? Get on base. What's the best way to do that? Yeah. Have your leadoff guy get on base. Who's the best team from the leadoff spot of baseball? Probably the Dodgers, right? Otani. Maybe the Nats, James Wood. No, Texas Rangers, brother. 906 OPS, Rangers out of the leadoff spot. Jock Peterson, Wyatt Langford, Brandon Nemo when he's up there. Great table setters. You want to win games. You got to get the leadoff guy on. And I'm going to be honest with you, Jake. I had a pretty tough time with this one. I really got nothing else. They're a good leadoff spot. Which is probably why they're going to make it. It's probably why they're going to win the wild card. There's nothing else I can say. I can't commit to this bit. They're the Rangers. They're just the most aggressively mid team in the sport.
I really, with all due respect, hope they're not the team we end up with. I just have very little to say about them. Their schedule is not great. They got to play the Brewers, the Rays, the Red Sox, the White Sox, the feisty Diamondbacks and the Mariners still. To me, the problem is Corey Seager is not very good. In the same way where I'm like, oh no, Jose Ramirez, he's the guy that carries the Guardians. They can't win without him. Seager looks way worse than Ramirez. Like, this seems like a real decline or injury related downturn for Seager. His production has been unbelievably disappointing. They have the second worst team ERA rotation since July 1st. DeGrom, Rocker, Gore, Eovaldi have all been either bad or unlucky. There's been a lot of bullpen regression here. I can't hey, if you're listening and you're a Rangers fan, email us, baseballbarbecue@gmail.com. Why do you believe in this team? I am certainly struggling to find a reason. Let's finish off this mess fest with the most talented team, hashtag on paper. Do you ever watch Love Island, British Love Island?
I've never watched any of the Love Islands, sorry to say.
So I got really into it during COVID, and one of the things that they would say was like, oh, he's 100% my type on paper. Like, that guy is my type on paper.
The Seattle Ryan Roland Smith, Mariners analyst?
Yeah. Type on paper. These Seattle Mariners, when you look at the roster on a sheet, you're like, yeah, like, look, hell yeah, dude. And yet all year, they have been a thunderstorm of frustration. On Friday night, they delivered probably their worst loss of what has been a disappointing season from hell, where up two in the ninth, Andrés Muñoz coughs up five, including a three-run walk-off tank from Christian Walker. At that point, they were 9 games under 500. They did battle back to win on Saturday and Sunday, holding on Sunday, 3-2. Cal Raleigh hitting a first-row Crawford box shot. Can this be the spark that gets the Seattle Mariners going? This week, they take their relative talents to where they're playing. They will be in Milwaukee. We'll be in Milwaukee. I'm sure that will make things a whole lot easier. Kevin, at the beginning of the year, we all thought the Seattle Mariners were legitimate World Series contenders. Instead, they have been legitimate Little League World Series pretenders. Nailed it. You are in or you are out?
Got to be in. You got to trust talent. You have to. You have to be in. You have no choice. Small sample size, right? The small sample size of 120-something games, but you've got a career for Cal Raleigh that backs up, he's going to be better. You got a career for Josh Naylor that backs up, he's going to be better. Brendan Donovan's playing, he's healthy. Randy Arozarena, one of the best outfielders in the sport. Julio Rodriguez, one of the best outfielders in the sport. Taylor Ward, he probably will hit a home run at some point. And, you know, 5 good starters, great stuff. It's like, same thing every year. Great starting rotation. I think it's the most talented team remaining. of these seven. And I think outside of Cleveland, they have the easiest remaining strength of schedule. I mean, you mentioned the Milwaukee series. It's not great. It's pretty cakewalky after that. So I believe in the talent. I believe in the rotation. I believe in the schedule. I believe in the Seattle Mariners. They showed what they're made of over the weekend in Houston after that crushing loss. Seattle Mariners, postseason 2026. Book your tickets now.
You can watch Humpy race. This defense stinks, dude. This is either the worst or second worst defense in the sport, depending on what kind of metrics you prefer to use. They have been bad all around the diamond. And there is no reason to expect that they're going to get any better at this. I think that, like, Brendan Donovan cutting his hair is a legitimate concern for me. That shows panic. You know, stick to your approach. He had looked like Steve the Pirate from Dodgeball for so long. He shaved and got a haircut. That's panic stations in my mind. The Mariners just don't have the sauce. They don't have the sauce. Dan Wilson, their manager, looks like a deer in headlights. The vibe is off. Something has seemed to miss all season long, and I don't really have faith that they're going to get it turned around in time. Kevin, we have done all these teams. Who do you believe in the most? You said that you believe in every single team. I said that I don't believe in any team. One of us, we have to pick someone. Someone has to end up in this spot. On today, Monday, August 17th, who gets the last AL wild card spot?
I think this is a very simple answer, actually. Seven-way tie, seven teams at 81 and 81.
And we let them all in. It would be a tie-breaking scenario.
We let them all in. Yeah, they each get an inning.
Open borders.
The Houston Astros. Everyone in. Yeah,
come on.
And whoever impressed most in their inning gets to play the eighth and the ninth against Houston.
Who is the team that you believe in the least?
I think Minnesota.
Okay. I think for me, it's Texas. And the Cleveland strength of schedule thing is really compelling. Like, that to me is a big part of the story.
Yeah. I mean, in my other life, in my Orioles life, right, you want to put your biased hat on in my position. But the Cleveland strength of schedule thing is so soft. And I genuinely can't get like hashtag guards ball last September out of my head.
Yeah.
And I've seen Foster Griffin pitch this year, and my God, is that guy nasty. So I'm probably a little tiny lean toward Cleveland in that respect.
The two easiest schedules, I'll just say the three easiest schedules in the sport left are the Blue Jays, Mariners, and the Guardians. The Blue Jays opponent winning percentage, like remaining opponent winning percentage, is 480. The Mariners are 471 and the Guardians are 452. Like, it is not a little worse. It is worse by a factor of, I guess, you know, 19 percentage points. For that reason, today on this morning, I'm going to pick the Guardians. This strength of schedule thing is like, that's a lot of games against a lot of bad teams that aren't really trying to win, that traded away guys at the deadline. And if the Guardians could just get their stuff together, I think they have the easiest path to a spot. Kevin, any final thoughts on the AL wild card before we put ourselves out of this misery?
Here's why I believe the Kansas City Royals can get back in this race.
And we'll be right back after this. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's go fast. It's time for turbo mode.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
The premier series of the weekend happened in Los Angeles, a four-game meeting between the two-time defending champs and the defending regular season champion, Milwaukee Brewers. The Brewers taking 3 out of 4 from the Dodgers in pretty convincing fashion. Edwin Diaz blows a save on Thursday. Yamamoto brilliant to get the job done on Friday. The Dodgers, behind an unbelievable Mizorowski start, win on Saturday. And then Logan Henderson outpitches Tarek Skubal on Sunday. Logan Henderson, the guy that the Brewers didn't want to give up for Tarek Skubal, looks Tarek Skubal dead in the face and says, "I'm built for this." The moment that I'll remember from this weekend was Mizorowski on Saturday. Bases juice, one out, 3-run game, Otani at the dish. Strikes out the 4-time MVP on 3 pitches, slot, curveball, heater, slider. 1 Cy Young, please. Thank you very much.
The 2 moments I'm going to remember from the series are, one, that Mizorowski won, which is funny because Miz said of Shohei, he knows what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw a heater. He's going to hit it or he's going to not hit it. And then he didn't throw him a heater on the biggest pitch of the game. The other moment would be yesterday in the 9th inning when Kyle Tucker dropped a fly ball at the wall and very nonchalantly went after it and got booed by Dodger fans. And it feels like this is the weekend where the Kyle Tucker thing really blew up and we need to talk about Kyle Tucker. I believe last week on the pod you invoked the Cancun clause for Cal Raleigh. Yes. And I'm wondering if we should invoke the Cancun clause for Kyle Tucker, who's hitting like 027 at home or something like that, so, and got benched because he was so bad at home.
The problem is that he's been moving like he's been on vacation all year long.
It's fair.
Kyle Tucker, who got $60 million to be the 7th best player on a baseball team, not being able to handle that responsibility, I find to be kind of embarrassing. The idea that you are the owner of the single largest single season contract outlay in MLB history, and 4 or 5 months into that situation, your manager is benching you because you can't handle the home crowd. Oh, and it just so happens it's on a day that Mizorowski is starting. That is not what big dogs do. Big dogs don't duck big dogs. And I thought that this was just weak and excuse-ridden BS from Kyle Tucker. I understand that Dave Roberts is the one who, like, in hilarious Dave Roberts fashion, half threw his own guy under the bus, as he so often does, in a refreshing manner. But the fact of the matter is, you know, Kyle Tucker went 0 for 19 at home. He did not have a single hit on the homestand across 6 games. That is really bad. And guess what? It might not matter because his Dodgers lineup is so good. At the same time, we can all giggle about it. Frustrations at home. Look, Kyle, a lot of people have frustrations at home.
We've all been there. Not with $60 million to our name, but this is an interesting inflection point for the Dodgers, right? Because the bullpen stinks right now. It's bad again. The defense, as astutely pointed out by our friend Mike Petriello, has been fairly poor the last 2 months. Their catchers are hurt. Right now, they wouldn't have a bye. They're 24th in August in runs per game. They're scoring 3.4 runs a game in August. And yesterday mattered, and Dave Roberts said, "I really wanted to win this game because it could matter, and I hope it doesn't come back to bite us." And Max Muncy said, "Today really sucked. We kind of needed to win this one, and we didn't. They lost the season series." So it's not like these guys are just waiting to flip the switch in October. Unless maybe they are again, like they are the Dodgers. And last year it was in September when the Dodgers came to Camden Yards, and I was there when the Dodgers came to Baltimore, and they were coming off of a series where they got swept by the Pirates. And Tanner Scott, who'd blown a ton of games, blew the game on Friday. Samuel Basayo hits a walk-off home run. And then Saturday, Yamamoto's got a no-hitter for 8 2/3. And Jackson Holliday hits a little cutter up to right, and Andy Páez decides not to try to rob the home run and to play the ball off the wall. And I don't know that that was looked at super kindly. And I just yesterday went back to some of the conversation around the Dodgers at that time. And it is very funny seeing Dodgers fans say after that game and the bad effort by Páez, and then they blow the no-hitter and blow the lead in the ninth. Like, we're cooked. This team doesn't have the juice. Fast forward to another parade. So we might just do this all over again. I'm also thinking about a couple of years ago. Remember when the Chiefs and the Eagles played that second Super Bowl and the Chiefs had just stolen another game from Buffalo in the AFC title? And I remember going into the Super Bowl thinking, the Eagles are better than the Chiefs in every way, but the Chiefs have Mahomes and they're the Chiefs. They'll figure it out. And then they lost the Super Bowl by like 87 points. Maybe this is Dodgers Brewers now. Like, maybe it's finally turned, and maybe we're going to look back on this weekend and go, the signs were all there. Or maybe the Dodgers are just going to be fine and they're the Dodgers and they'll figure it out, which to me still seems like the most likely option. But we're now in a plausible enough world where either divergent path, you can say, oh yeah, we saw this coming.
I think that if you break the units up, the offense looking lethargic and somewhat old, I am concerned about that. The bullpen having to rely on a out of sorts Edwin Diaz and not much else, I'm concerned about that. But I am so unconcerned about the starting pitching that the Dodgers can just roll into October and throw Skubal and Yamamoto and a healthy Snell and maybe a healthy Ohtani or a healthy Glasnow. Like, last October, they won the World Series because of their starting pitching, and that starting pitching is just as good as it's ever been. Is it harder if your defense is worse and your bullpen is worse and your offense is worse? Absolutely. I believe that one of those other units is going to wake up from its slumber, and I think that the starting pitching still gives this team such a preposterous floor come October. I think for the Brewers, the series was really important because we saw the final ascension of a key contributor in Jake Bowers. And that sounds a little silly, but the best hitter on the best team in baseball is Jake Bowers, who has turned his career around with a breakout season that, by all the peripheral, all the under the hood stuff, looks incredibly real. We're talking hard hit, barrel, chase rates in the 90th percentile or above. He is someone, this version of him is not someone that the Brewers had last year. And so when we compare the Brewers team last year to the Brewers team this year, Mizorowski going from dude that threw really hard to best pitcher in the world, Jake Bowers ascending into legitimate middle of the order hitter, another half step forward from Jackson Churio, and you can see a club that can compete with even the best version of the Dodgers. That's what this weekend was about for me. Logan Henderson, what he did on that stage in that setting, like, yes, you don't want to pick too much out from any individual regular season game, but watching Logan Henderson yesterday, I'm like, oh yeah, this dude has the stones to get it done in October, right? And so I think with Kyle Harrison kind of falling back to earth and who else is in this rotation, that to me was a big moment as well for those Milwaukee Brewers. Let's finish our show up. Kevin, you have the Pirates tonight. You are in Pittsburgh. The Pirates of the weekend at home took 2 out of 3 from the Boston Red Sox with nice offensive performances. This looked like the Pirates from April and May and June, the team that was scoring runs in buckets. Skeens gets his start pushed back. He was supposed to start on Sunday. We talked about his velocity dwindling last week. He's going to start Wednesday instead. This whole situation is very weird, but at least the Buccos got a series win. Kevin, as you prepare to talk about the Pittsburgh Pirates on television this evening, where is this team at in your head?
It's a lot different than when I was preparing to talk about them Friday. 7 straight series losses until they beat Boston. And I think the Red Sox project has finally, understandably, come back to earth. I think they'll still be fine because we just spent an hour talking about how bad the rest of the American League is. But the Red Sox will be fine. The Pirates could use O'Neill Cruz, who should be back soon. Unfortunately, they could use Ryan O'Hearn, and he will not be back soon. They could use Nick Gonzalez, who missed the last couple of games after getting hit in the helmet. He might be back tonight. The Rafael Flores Jr. run is fun. Esmeraldine Valdez had a great weekend. You know, the Pirates are in the wrong league. Like, if the Pirates are in the American League, they might be the second or the third wild card right now. And we might have needed a completely different segment, too, because the Pirates might just be better than everybody else in the American League wild card race. But they're in the wrong league, in a National League that's a lot better. And I'm selfishly bummed not to have Paul Skenes tonight, because it's such a fascinating story. And you and Jordan did a fantastic job last week on the pod talking about all the possibilities for Paul Skenes. But rest assured, it will still be a big part of the discussion. And ultimately, look, I like what Pittsburgh's done this year. If Paul Skenes is not going to be Paul Skenes again, there's too much ground to overcome for this team, realistically. Yeah. So maybe the extra days of rest are going to turn him back into Paul Skenes. I hope so, because is there a more precious asset in the sport to a team than Paul Skenes' right arm to the Pittsburgh Pirates? I don't think so. I just hope he gets right. I hope this weird whatever it is doesn't linger. But the Pirates, yeah, kind of fun again. Kind of a fun weekend. The story tonight is the Tigers.
I'm excited about this series because there's an element of desperation here where a sweep win or a sweep loss for either of these teams could just dramatically change their fortunes. They're both kind of teetering on the edge of being back, of not being back. We'll see what happens tonight. I will be tuning in so I can listen to my friend Kevin talk about baseball. Other baseball games that happened over the weekend. Braves, Diamondbacks in Atlanta. The Diamondbacks taking 2 out of 3. Very impressive outing for Brandon Pfaadt on Friday. He outduels Chris Sale. Brings his ERA down to 3.11. He's straight up been one of the best arms in the sport for a long while now. The Snakes win that one 2-0. They win big on Saturday, 10-3. Two homers from Nolan Arenado, who will not go gently into that good night. But the Braves avoid the sweep on Sunday. Matt Olson goes yard left on left against Brandon Garcia. Understandable if some of you don't know about Brandon Garcia. He's probably the best left-on-left pitcher in the sport. Like, he is as tough of an at-bat for a lefty as exists, and Matt Olson cares not for that. He hits a late big homer to give the Braves a win on Sunday, staying in the National League East. The Mets, these post-deadline juggernaut Mets, continue to have a grand old time, sweeping the Nationals in Queens, sweeping the Nationals out of the NL wildcard picture once and for all. The Nats announced pregame on Friday that CJ Abrams is going to be moving, not apartments or cities, but just from shortstop over to second base. Nassim Nunez, who's been playing second base, will move over to short. This is a key moment, in my opinion, because until the Nationals did this, I thought the priority was kind of fattening up CJ Abrams's trade value. Nassim Nunez is a far superior defender. And so the Nats were kind of seeding on-field outcomes in the hope that Abrams would get better at this and that would either help them trade him or that it would help them down the road. They have pulled the plug on that. He's going to start playing more second base moving forward and be the primary guy there. But the highlight of this series, Jeffrey Yahn, who we have spoken quite about, the jumping bean out of the Mets bullpen, threw a pitch on Saturday on a 1-2 count that was just a couple balls off the edge of the strike zone. He jumped in the air. He tapped his head. The pitch was not overturned. This is what the kids call an aura loss. Kevin, what have you made of the Jeffrey Yahn experience?
Just a total aura win all the way around. I am so happy watching this, and I just want us to bottle up this happiness and bottle up this joy for the inevitable moment where Jeffrey Yahn strikes out a guy in a blowout game and that guy takes it too personally and he shouts at him and Jeffrey's like, what are you doing? I'm just having fun. And I don't know why I just had this accent all of a sudden. And hey, the bench is Jeffrey empty Young. And there's a dust up. Hey, big Jeffy here. Like, until this becomes a flashpoint that goes beyond the baseball media and everybody in the world of media, all the media has a take on this. I just want to enjoy this. It's fun. It's silly. It's a Mets team that all of a sudden has the vibes they were hoping for all year when they're well out of it. Like, yeah, this is great. This dude was a roofer for 4 years. This guy was released by the Rockies minor leagues a year ago. Let him kick his glove in the air after a strikeout. I don't care. This is fun. So I'm just reminding myself when this inevitably comes some sort of like non-baseball culture war thing, just let the guy have fun.
Banana ball through first principles is what I have called the Jeffrey Young experience. He has found this essential joy, like this showmanship is so authentic because he is simply happy to be there. And that is uncomfortable in the baseball bro hubris mentality where like it's not about being there, it's about succeeding there and being great there. And I'm not saying that Jeffrey Young is like content necessarily, but like he is. Like he was a roofer. He's in the big leagues. He's going to jump. Sorry. That's just how it goes.
Let me ask you this, because you cover the college game a lot. You cover college baseball. I cover college softball. Like people are banging on the dugout, pitch after pitch. Sure. They got crazy rally unicorns and stuff. They're doing chants. College baseball, like there's a real passion that's obviously in college baseball. Guys doing bat flips and throwing open their jerseys and yelling. Is this where we're trending a little more in MLB, do you think? Do you think that's going to stay limited to let college be weird?
I think we're already sort of moving there, and we have moved there. There is a longer conversation about the sort of let the kids have fun discourse and how that's changed over time and how guys like, you know, Carlos Gomez and Bryce Harper and, you know, Ricky Henderson dating back have kind of changed the way that emotion is accepted within the sport. I think there is a line where it goes from enjoyable to campy or from campy to over the top. And that will inevitably like grind some people down. But I think that the stakes of it all and the quality of player that exists at the level will always keep the train on the rails to a certain extent in a way that just isn't the case in college baseball. College softball, I can't speak to quite as much. I think that's a little bit different. I think that college softball culture is a little bit different, a lot of bit different. That is kind of the highest level in terms of like the most visibility. But I think that Major League Baseball will never fully bananify itself because it can't really afford to within the sort of like atmosphere that it has created for itself. There were three other series over the weekend. The Marlins took 2 out of 3 over the Reds. The Royals took 2 out of 3 over the Angels, and the Rockies and Giants played. I legitimately don't know who won that series. The two highlights there are the Reds and Marlins are kind of like sticking around in the wild card picture, whatever. Chase Burns was great on Friday for the Reds. And then Jack Caglione is like very much figuring it out in what has been a lost Royals season. Well, like next year when you're preparing for your fantasy league and you're like, oh my God, Jack Caglione did what last year? Like, just remember that I said this. He went 3 for 4 with 5 RBI and a homer on Friday. Kevin Brown, thank you for filling in for Jordan Schusterman. Thank you for your friendship and your time and your compassion. And thank you for being the voice of a baseball team that has been at times uplifting, at times inspirational, at times frustrating and disheartening. And through it all, people in Birdland have been gifted quite the opportunity, and that is to listen to you and your perspectives and your kindnesses and the sweet, soothing sound of your voice for the last number of years. Is there anything else you'd like to say, get off your chest, plug before we get on out of here?
No, I just want to say thank you. This was such a thrill. I think I was on with you guys on a live show a couple of years ago from outside Camden Yards. And then we had our, you know, our backyard baseball live streams back in 2020, which hopefully we don't have to go back to next year. But a thrill to be a legitimate co-host. And I am happy that Jordan will come back and restore some sanity to this podcast soon.
Me too. Kevin, you're a good guy. I don't care what all those other people have to say. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ross Tudor for producing this program. Thanks to you, the listeners, for listening with your ears. Have a phenomenal week of baseball, and we'll talk to you on Wednesday.